There's something happening here. But what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I've got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
Welcome home to Passionate Justice 76. Thank you all for your continuing growing support. I'm so pleased more and more of you are following the show on Twitter for all Passionate Justice news, releases, podcasts. I ask all of you follow the show on Twitter at JWolf41387, at JWOLF41387. Now a new hour, personal notes, super guest writers spurring you on every week, every day, a new challenge to create a little more justice in our world. And join our salon, the very best readers and writers site on the net, growing and hosted by Lori Wright, and it's free. Join at www.oursalon.ning.com, www.oursalon.ning.com. I am author activist Jonathan Wolfman, and the spark, as you know, for these stories, Passionate Justice, a progressive memoir in essays, is available at Amazon, and I'm so proud to say underwriting for Passionate Justice in 2015 comes from Bud Clayman and ODC 87 Productions, producers of OC 87, RecoveryDiaries.com, and the feature-length film OC 87, the obsessive-compulsive major depression bipolar Asperger's movie. Check out OC87RecoveryDiaries.com. So straight away, I want to remind you, and this is the last call, our very important program note and a request that could put you on the air. We're in the run-up, you know, to the 40th anniversary of the fall of Saigon, and if you're honest, you'll agree that our Viet War vets have been treated shabbily. But on April 30, our morning show, Upfront and Outspoken with Bob Williams, will honor our men and women who served in Southeast Asia. And yes, you can be a part. If you have a personal experience you wish to share for this tribute, please, now, email Bob Williams at kkrp1610@yahoo.com, and in the subject line, just write VET, V-E-T, kkrp1610@yahoo.com, and be a part of an amazing tribute. And stick around. As we wrap today, we're going to hear a war memory from Passionate Justice writer, medical doctor, Army medic, Clayton, George's Dr. Rodney Rowe. Thanks to all of you so much. Get on the air with your Vietnam War story. I want to open today talking about religious freedom. It's been in the news a lot lately. You know, religious freedom works only when you and I are able to live with or without religion. That's the only way religious freedom works. I say that because, as writer Zaid Jilani at Alternet writes, the phrase, the banner, religious liberty, is not only used to cover homophobia's bum, but it's been used to justify racism, sexism, slavery throughout history, throughout American history. There's been an enormous backlash from Indiana's decision to enact a law that would allow businesses to discriminate if they invoke religious liberty. Responding to a flurry of boycott threats, Republican Governor Mike Pence signed a so-called fix to the bill he says would prevent it from being used to discriminate, but for the religious us right? The battle lines are drawn. 2016 presidential contenders Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, Bobby Jindal, Rick Santorum, Ben Carson, others have all rushed to defend Indiana's legislation as a number of state legislatures continue to debate enacting similar and more draconian measures. In Louisiana, one Republican lawmaker is introducing a narrower bill specifically aiming at marriage, with the intent to allow businesses to discriminate against same-sex weddings and deny benefits to employees in same-sex marriages. In all of these examples, religious belief is invoked to justify a right to discriminate. See, it's no surprise these laws are proliferating around the same time marriage equality is slowly becoming the law in most of the country. You see, it's nothing more than a fitful last gasp. Yet understand this. I really want you to understand this, people. Cries of religious liberty and a religious-based right to discriminatory and harmful behavior, they are not new. For centuries, religion has been abused as a shield for harmful behavior to justify everything from mass slaughter to slavery to sexist violence to racist legislation. In today's history books, the righteous deeds of abolitionists, many of them devout Christians, are rightly documented, showing how the Christian gospel was used to liberate millions of human beings who had been subjugated by slavery. Yet many of their pro-slavery opponents also invoked biblical tradition. In 1852, for example, the writer Josiah Priest, no, I didn't invent his name, Josiah Priest published a book titled Bible Defense of Slavery and Origin, Fortunes, and History of the Negro Race. The publisher's preface reinforces the belief that the institution of slavery received the sanction of the Almighty. Priest quotes liberally from Scripture, citing numerous examples of enslavement being sanctified in the Bible. He wrote, "God does not ever sanction sin, so we must conclude that it is not sinful to enslave the Negro race." Mr. Priest was just one of thousands of biblical experts assuring the South that slavery was ethical, and it was not until, wait for it, 1995 that the Southern Baptist Convention organization issued an apology for its former stance on slavery. 1995? And as to sexism, the Seneca Falls Women's Rights Convention of 1848 was one of the major gatherings of the women's movement, and it's considered to have been one of the turning points for suffragists. In the Declaration of Sentiments and Resolutions, those activists there compiled, they specifically included a provision condemning those who would use the Bible to suppress their rights, quote, "resolved that the woman has too long rested satisfied in circumscribed limits which corrupt customs and a perverted application of the Scriptures have marked out for her, and that it is time she should move in the enlarged sphere which her Creator has assigned her," unquote. Clinging to verses in the Bible that gave unequal status to men and women, opponents of the suffragists justified their beliefs with religious teachings. Quote, "Who demand the ballot for women? They are not lovers of God, nor are they believers in Christ. They prefer an infidel's cheer to the favor of God and the love of the Christian community. It's because of this tendency that the majority of those who contend for the ballot for women cut loose from the legislation of heaven," said Justin Fulton, the prominent reverend, when in 1869 the religious-based bigotry against women was so intense that Elizabeth Cady Stanton actually wrote the Woman's Bible to directly challenge religious oppression of women. And what about Jim Crow's defenders? Other than the Christian Rights modern-day campaign against LGBT citizenship rights, The most recent use of scripture in religious liberty to justify discrimination was the 20th century defense of Jim Crow. Mississippi Senator Theodore Bilbo used his religious faith to justify preventing the integration of the races. Quote, "Purity of race is a gift of God, and God in his infinite wisdom has so ordained it that when man destroys his racial purity, it can never be redeemed," wrote Bilbo in the book Take Your Choice, Separation or Mongrelization. That's one hell of a word, mongrelization. Segregationist Governor George Wallace, of course, invoked, how many times? 27 times God in his famous speech that came to be known as Segregation Now, Segregation Forever. Now, none of this is to argue that religious values cannot inspire individuals to do good. Towering figures such as the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and Mother Teresa improved the lives of millions and used scripture to liberate people, not to oppress them, but a cursory review of the history shows that invoking religious preference to justify discrimination and oppression is a common and very shabby tool. That's why, although the Constitution guarantees your right to practice your religion, it also prevents the government from using it to deny people basic citizenship rights. The current debates over religious liberty are hardly new. They are simply new cover for using religion to deny the rights of American citizenship, an old, tired routine that harms both the church and the state, and it demeans us all. Now, from writer Candace Choi, an update on the fast food workers' protests. And as you hear this, I want you to bear this in mind. The average fast food worker is 27 years old and has kids. She's not a teen. The fight to redefine a McJob is heating up. Protests for a pay of $15 an hour and a union for fast food and other low-wage workers took place around the country last Wednesday, marking the biggest effort yet in an ongoing campaign by labor organizers. The push comes just 2 weeks after McDonald's announced a pay bump for workers at its company-owned stores, suggesting the chain's trying to take control of its image as an employer. The Fight for 15 campaign is being spearheaded by the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, and began in late 2012 with fast food workers. Since then, the campaign has morphed to a rally with a variety of low-wage workers on, and including airport workers and home care workers. Adjunct professors will be among the latest to join the demonstrations. Adjunct professors are treated shabbily too, and organizers say they're planned for more than 230 cities and on college campuses. McDonald's remains a focus of the protests, and that the company's recent pay bump shows fast food workers already have a de facto union. It shows the workers are winning. The first national pay policy announced by McDonald's includes a starting salary that's a dollar above the local minimum wage and the ability to accrue to paid time off. It only applies to workers at company-owned stores, however, which account for about, what, only 10% of the more than 14,300 McDonald's locations. That means McD's is digging in its heels over a central issue for labor organization, whether it has the power to set wages at franchised restaurants. McDonald's, Burger King, and Wendy's say they don't control the employment decisions at franchised restaurants, but the SEIU is working to change that and hold McDonald's Corp responsible for labor conditions at franchised restaurants in multiple ways, including through lawsuits. The demonstrations got an early start. Tuesday afternoon in Boston, where several hundred people, including college students, low-wage workers, and their supporters, gathered for a rally. In the evening, protesters in Detroit gathered inside a McDonald's, and organizers say three employees walked off the job as part of the protests. Ahead of the protest this week, a study funded by the SEIU found working families rely on $153 billion in public assistance a year as a direct result of their low wages. Already, organizers say the Fight for 15 is changing the way people think about this kind of low-wage work. Last year, more than a dozen states and multiple cities raised their minimum wages, according to the National Employee Law Project. Walmart Stores Incorporated, which also has been targeted with protests for higher wages and better treatment, also recently announced pay hikes. So you tell me, passionate justice listeners, you tell me, what makes more sense? A national, respectful, moral minimum wage, or more and more people on welfare? Now, do you remember the hashtag Bring Back Our Girls? HuffPo's Charlotte Alfred and Nick Robbins Early tell us that this is what happened. This is what has gone on in the 12 months since there was the sad necessity for the hashtag Bring Back Our Girls. You know, you'll recall, I hope, that on the night of 14 April 2014, hundreds of girls, schoolgirls, at the Chibok boarding school in northeastern Nigeria awoke to the sound of gunfire. They saw men in camouflage approaching and thought the soldiers were coming back to save them from a militant attack. Instead, of course, more than 270 schoolgirls found themselves in the clutches of the Islamist militant group Boko Haram. Their abduction sparked a global outrage and a huge campaign talking about and calling for, demanding their rescue, partly propelled by the hashtag at Bring Back Our Girls. On Tuesday, the first anniversary of the kidnapping, President-elect Buhari said in a statement, "We do not know if the Chibok girls can be rescued. Their whereabouts remain unknown. Tuesday marks a year since the girls were kidnapped." Here's what's happened. Not one student has been rescued. In the first days after the abduction, 57 of the girls did manage to escape, but not one has been rescued since then. An estimated 219 remain missing, even though they were reportedly located in the months after the attack. In May, last May, a Nigerian military official claimed he knew where the girls were being held. In July, U.S. surveillance planes spotted groups that officials did believe to be these girls. Nigeria's government has defended its approach to the crisis, warning that a rescue effort might risk the girls' lives. There are also reports that the girls have been dispersed and split up from the original group, while Boko Haram has claimed in a statement released in the fall that they were made to marry fighters from the group. Nigeria's military initially buckled under pressure, complaining of a lack of weapons. At least 40 Nigerian soldiers reportedly refused orders to fight Boko Haram last August. Hundreds of Nigerian troops were reported to have fled across the border into Cameroon during operations last fall, although the Nigerian government claimed that some of them were performing a tactical maneuver. Nigeria's military has cracked down on desertion and severely punished soldiers for disobeying orders. In one such incident, more than 50 soldiers were sentenced to death by firing squad for mutiny, and that was this past December. Nigeria's security forces and state-sponsored militias have long been accused of horrific abuses, including kidnappings, tortures, extrajudicial killings. Following a government crackdown on Boko Haram in September, evidence emerged that authorities had tortured and killed countless civilians accused of being connected to the militant group. My God, what a mess. While the country worried about its image problem, Nigeria's government paid a Washington public relations firm more than 1.2 million to change the media narrative surrounding the schoolgirl's abduction, according to a June report by the newspaper The Hill, that's here in Washington, D.C. Ultimately, others in the region stepped in to launch a military operation, and according to the Associated Press, the AP, it took more than two weeks for Nigeria to accept offers of international assistance to find the schoolgirls. When other countries did send assistance, they initially didn't get very far. The U.S. sent 80 troops in late May to coordinate an aerial search from neighboring Chad. Canada, France, Israel, and the United Kingdom also sent special forces. But at the beginning of July, the Pentagon press secretary announced that the U.S. mission would be scaled back, saying, quote, "We don't have any better idea today than we did before about where these girls are," unquote. In 2015, regional countries agreed. This year, regional countries there agreed to set up a multinational military effort to stop Boko Haram's campaign of terror. Niger, Cameroon, Benin, Chad, all committed troops to the African Union initiative for a 10,000-strong force that would take on Boko Haram. In March, just last month, Chad and Niger launched their own separate military offensives to drive back Boko Haram. But despite gains, experts have voiced concern over the long-term effectiveness of the campaigns, with Comfort Iro of the International Crisis Group telling NPR News that, quote, "A short-term immediate military action doesn't lead to a more sustained outcome, especially if it doesn't deal with the root causes of that conflict," unquote. So, Nigeria's military launched an invigorated offensive against the group this past March in what they called a final onslaught against Boko Haram, the nation's military finally pushed into areas under the group's control. The escalated efforts came weeks before the national elections, which were previously postponed due to security concerns and a plan to ramp up the assault against the insurgency before the vote. As troops took over militant-held towns, they found tragedy left by the violence. After retaking the city of Gwoza from Boko Haram in late March, the Nigerian military found burnt-out homes, war-torn landscape. The Washington Post reported all of this: killings, rapes, other violence widespread in just one town under Boko Haram. In one chilling case, a man forced to work for the militants reported that they cut off his arm as a form of punishment under its interpretation of Islamic Sharia law. In addition to these horrific crimes against the civilian population, the group was also reported to have been forcibly recruiting kids to fight in its behalf. In the meantime, Boko Haram has pledged allegiance to ISIS. In early March of 2015, Boko Haram leader Abu Bakr Shekau issued an audio message pledging that allegiance to ISIS, and Nigeria elected a new president in a historic election, marking the first democratic change of power in modern Nigerian history. The nation voted 72-year-old former military general Muhammadu Buhari in as president. Buhari defeated the incumbent, President Jonathan. Meanwhile, Boko Haram violence rages on. In 2014, listen to this, a total of 6,300-plus civilians were killed by Boko Haram-related fighting. That's from The Guardian. Boko Haram has kidnapped at least 2,000 women and girls since the start of 2014, according to Amnesty International. In one particular incident in March of this year, last month, militants of the group allegedly kidnapped around 500 women and kids from a town in northeast Nigeria, killing some as the group fled, according to Reuters. Reuters said the Nigerian government played down reports of the attack. Reuters is a very responsible, well-respected news outlet in England, people. Death tolls have decreased in 2015, but still average in the thousands. not each year, but each month, displacing 800,000 children from their homes. In the year after the nearly 300 girls were kidnapped from Chibok, the number of children out of primary school has risen to 10.5 million, according to the United Nations. This is the largest such population in any country in the world. Now, I'm really going to switch it up with you now. You know, a few weeks back, I myself wrote a piece, and it got a lot of notice, and I want to share it with you. I called this piece, Hitler Lost, Nazism Won. Berlin, squeezed by Russians, Adolf Hitler took his life, the Reich lost. Yet Nazism won, as it wholly altered and in modernizing anti-Semitism reinvented and reinvigorated the lunacy. Prior to the SS, European Jew hatred flowered in two incarnations. When Rome converted, Christianity became lethal to Jews in successive and overlapping waves. Religious anti-Semitism. Convert or die. You may not live here as Jews. Then, political anti-Semitism. Leave or die. You may not live here. The irony of Nazism's transformative recasting of anti-Semitism was such that it didn't need the Reich to survive, for it to thrive. The third incarnation of anti-Semitism, racial anti-Semitism, says, you are a cancer, Jew, on humanity, a pathogen, you may not live. So again, you may not live here as Jews, you may not live here, you may not live. Nazism won because isolating and condemnatory racialist ideologies are far more powerful, incendiary, infecting, and infectious and lasting than marginalizing political and religious ideologies are. I'm going to say that one again. Nazism won because isolating and condemnatory racialist ideologies are far more powerful, incendiary, infecting, and infectious and lasting than marginalizing political and religious ideologies are. There remains no anti-Semitism that isn't rife with racialist assumptions, stated or no. There lingers no anti-Semitism limiting itself to religious and or political solutions. This is why the founding documents of every neo-Nazi group and every self-identified anti-Israel terror organization does not waste much time excoriating Israel. This is why every one of their founding documents, whether written hard upon the Third Reich's destruction or much later, announces as its core purpose the extermination of Jews everywhere and the elimination of Israel as a path to the prize, the answer to the cancer, the once and future solution. And we will be right back. Welcome to the second half of Passionate Justice 76. I remind you, last call, last call. Share, do please share your Vietnam War stories with our upfront and outspoken host, Bob Williams and his morning show. And you may have your story shared on the air on the 30th of this month, the 40th anniversary of Saigon's fall, and follow the show on Twitter, this show, Passionate Justice. Follow us on Twitter at JWOLF41387. And now, a very special Passionate Justice, We Are Volunteers of America moment. We've heard numbers of times from Seattle's Robin Snead, homeless herself, and a keen reporter on the lives of many homeless citizens there. But you see now from Robin Snead, a miracle. Robin writes this to us. Miracles always arrive in our moments of total acceptance, don't they? I'd accepted nearly 4 years of homelessness and had decided that if I died homeless, I'd be okay. I thought, I have friends I love, love me, we've made this work, and if this is the way it's meant to be, I accept. I looked skyward that afternoon, asked for the last time, why? Jay and I decided to make our own transition out of homelessness in the last stretch by putting together every last resource we had to stay in weekly motels. After living in shelters and on the street, we went through every expected change. We slept and felt like we couldn't quite wake up sometimes, stressed hard over being able to continue the transition. After a few months, we started to stand up. We continued working on the Safewire and Uber counter cookbook and a project called Maison d'Ette. Maison d'Ette with Alyssa Todaro Brooks at the University of Maryland for her class on urban public health, and one afternoon I accepted homelessness as my condition. I began thinking about the very real possibility that we'd go back to the shelter or back to the street. Exactly 24 hours, almost to the minute, I thought of all these things. The phone rang, and it was Jay's case manager. He had one directive, call landlord liaisons. They've got a place to show you. Jay looked at me speechless. When he told me, I could hardly parse it. We called, an appointment was made, two people who were at that point willing to take whatever we could get that involved a roof over our heads, that we could handle financially and mentally. We were shown a little dream home. At one bedroom wing in a neighborhood palace with a little front yard and a local food and clothing bank, literally steps out our front door. It would seem the universe had custom created this for us. And within a week, the paperwork was signed and we were moving in all at once, our knowing we had to start the transition months before made sense. We were ready to walk into our home and live life again. No sleeping all the time. No worrying about the very real dangers of homelessness. Not altogether ready to let go of our profound attachment to the homeless community. But that's a story for next time. We had no furniture, of course, but we had kitchenware because of the counter. When we had made and shared food with our fellow homeless persons in downtown Seattle, we started there at the hearth, and quickly that expanded to a visit to Share House to shop for furniture. We were gifted with a trip to Goodwill, where I found the couch I had been thinking of, and thinking there was no way it could happen financially, I had decided on another sofa when the one I wanted came along for $170. We were gifted with my black leather sectional dream. We received an antique table with the Star of David on the top. A couple weeks later, Uncle John, that's what Robin calls me, Uncle John asked me to write about this otherworldly experience. I had asked her to write about it. I've cataloged the experience here, but it will be a little while before I can describe the joy, the surreal feeling of being home after years of being without. There was one piece of furniture given us by our landlord, Jim, when we moved in, an antique china cabinet. I call it my wardrobe after the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. It holds our last mementos of homelessness, broken radio that stayed with us till its last gasp, couple bars of motel soap, our last little gifts one another when we tried to make a Valentine's Day during the transition, a glass heart given me by someone, it was anonymous, on Christmas Day, and a little sign with an arrow that says, "This way to the beach." When I walk by the cabinet, I sometimes imagine I'm going through the wardrobe to see Aslan, because this walk, this experience, this condition we've been moved through is like coming into springtime. Thank you to everyone who has been following our story on Passionate Justice, and for your prayers and good wishes. We are well convinced that those are the elements of the wave that brought us into our new community, and I know you join me in wishing Robin and Jay continued all best and good luck in their transition to home. Now, our friend Virginia writer John Guzlowski, you know that he grew up in Chicago, and I've shared with you poems and stories he's written about Chicago, and I want to share this one. He simply calls this, after the lyric, the Robert Johnson lyric, "Sweet Home Chicago." John says, "I grew up in a section of Chicago that was called Murder Town in the local papers. This was back in the 50s, 60s, early 70s. My friends were beaten, stabbed, pulled from their bicycles and cars, knocked into the street. One of my friends was dragged out of his house by a gang, beaten with clubs till he was unconscious. He was a good boy, kind of sissy-like, with long hair and a soft voice, but a good boy. He was in the hospital for about a month. He didn't want ever to leave it. One time, a man was shot dead in front of my house. When I went outside after the police showed up to see what they were doing, a cop called me a motherfucker and told me he'd throw my ass in jail if I didn't get back home. I was 12. I went back into the house and never stepped outside again when someone was shot in front of my house. I carried a knife, a switchblade, in my pocket. Twice I used it on someone so that they wouldn't hurt me. Once it was a friend who was just joking around. He jumped out of an alley when he saw me passing. I didn't know he was joking. I stabbed him in the stomach. When I couldn't get a knife, I carried a hammer or a baseball bat. The hammer was better, lighter. I could put it in my belt. Every couple of years there were riots, mostly in summer. One time, it was so bad that Mayor Daley, the old one, felt cops needed some backup, so we called in the National Guard. The soldiers drove around the neighborhood in jeeps with loaded machine guns. Nights, you could hear the shooting, see flames rolling off apartment buildings, burning just south of us. Three of the priests at my old parish, St. Fidelis, were convicted years later of being pedophiles. They heard my confessions and told me to say three Hail Marys and three Our Fathers. They weren't interested in me. One time a gang attacked my mother and me when we were coming home from the supermarket. This was an early afternoon, bright, warm. We were carrying shopping bags and they wanted to steal our food. We fought them off. My mother beat one of the gang boys down to the sidewalk. He tried to crawl away, but she kept kicking him and kicking him. He pleaded with his homeboys to come save him from my mom. They wouldn't come. They were afraid. Finally, my mother stopped kicking the gang boy, and she let him crawl away. My mother had survived 2 years of life in a concentration camp, and she knew how to get by in the streets of Chicago, our old neighborhood. Murder Town. We finally had to move when the house we'd been living in was burned to the ground during a gang war in the early 70s. Nobody ever rebuilt on that spot. It's still an empty lot in Murder Town, 42 years later. I must, and I know you, thank John Guzlowski, our old friend, for that remarkable piece. What a mom that man had. Now, a writer new to Passionate Justice, and new for us too, a bit of experimental writing perhaps. This is from Nicole Callahan of New York, with a prose poem, Digital Poets and Nature, How to Imagine a Fractal. How to Imagine a Fractal, since both the sky and the heart operate in a finite pixel space, we can mostly ignore the paradoxes that arise from infinite recursion. We will instead construct our code without the intention of forever, removing the notion of forever. Minus F allows, ironically, for forever to emerge. The sky is, in this sense, as deep and as wide as it is deep and wide. To understand this, imagine blood vessels, say, broken in an old lover's eyes, the one who smelled of crab cakes and musk, or, more compassionately, the vessels strikingly visible in the soft aging skin of your mother's décolletage. Or is it yours? If the blood vessels yield nothing, imagine the weeping willow you sought solace under as a child. The South Carolina heat was oppressive. You hated the people that pressed in around you, not all of them, but the ones who pressed the hardest. This is not a story in your mind. You were really that girl. She was already you. The tree offered what shelter trees can offer, which is to say, great shelter. The women who came before, the women who came before, the women who came before you lived under those trees, in those trees. They beat the sky with those limbs. Those limbs beat the sky more simply. You can imagine cauliflower uneaten on your daughter's plate. She doesn't eat enough. She says she's afraid of cream. She just turned 6. Imagine a circle inside a circle, a heart inside a heart, hunger inside hunger. Draw a line from one side of the paper to the other. Erase the middle third of that line. Repeat step 2 for the remaining lines again and again and again. This is called an infinite set. See George Cantor or your mother-in-law's beauty parlor now. Step under those lines. Imagine they are limbs. Listen to the birds. Fight sleep. Be lulled by the algorithmic beauty of the tree, the back and forth of forever. Minus F, becoming what you already are. Now, Nicole Callahan. She writes poems, stories, and essays. Her work has appeared in the Elle magazine, Cream City Review, Forklift, Ohio, and Painted Bride Quarterly. Among other journals, her books include Superloop. Superloop, a collection of poems published in early 2014 by Suck Monkey Press. She teaches at NYU, that's New York University. She lives in Brooklyn with her husband and daughters. Find her on the web at Nicole Callahan. Thank you, Nicole, for allowing Passionate Justice to break one more important literary, psychic justice barrier. Now, Ed Mazza at HuffPo raises up a man, Dixon White, a self-described redneck, whose viral video calls out white America for its racism. He's taking the internet by storm with his call for white Americans to stand up against racism, take responsibility for it, acknowledge that we've benefited, we white people, from racism, whether we've wanted to or not. He says this country was built for white people, and it's time white Americans came to terms with that, realize we're benefiting from it. The man who goes by the pseudonym Dixon White says in his clips, "We created a culture and a system of white supremacy that has benefited us for 400 years, he says, with a thick southern drawl and a clip recording from the cab of his Ford pickup. I think maybe it's about time we stopped being lazy as white people and take some fucking responsibility." In the video titled "I'm a Redneck and I Love America," he says this, "There's a new South and a new America, and it's called white racial responsibility. It's time we took some of that, y'all. Let's take a little bit of white racial responsibility. Let's start by standing up against racism. Let's recognize that in every American institution, in education, financial, healthcare, justice, for God's sake, it's injustice. It's injustice in the police departments. And our police offers too many of them. And I'm not talking about all. I ain't saying all white people are bad. Not all cops are bad. I'm saying we've got an evil called white supremacy in our culture. Stop being defensive. Get off your ass. Do something. Speak up. Don't ever ignore racism. If you hear something racist, stand up as a white American. Take some fucking responsibility. It's your inaction that has always destroyed other people and other nations." Dixon says in the clip that he was once a white supremacist himself. "Yeah, I'm a redneck," he says. "I always have been, but I'm a redneck who's reformed." He wrote on Facebook that he has a white mother and a Cuban dad. He says, "Many years I was a racist and didn't like blacks. I used to use the word nigger." White said going to college where he had a black roommate helped to change his point of view. "So did suffering from abuse due to prejudice. Once I understood prejudice, it made me open to not being a product of it and not participate in it any longer," he said. "I learned through suffering. I was gonna fight against racism. I made an oath to myself and to God I'd fight against racism, put it behind me." In less than 10 days, people, listen to this. In less than 10 days, his most popular video has received 800,000 views on YouTube and has been shared across social media. The actor and filmmaker who hopes to make a movie about white supremacy has since released a few more clips, including a call for others to join him. White is asking Americans to post their own clips, owning up to and taking responsibility racially. He wants the videos, quote, "to address our culture and systems of white supremacy without a but, without denial, without a defense of it." And already a number of people, white and black, have answered that call. And I hope you all who are hearing my voice, John Wolfman's voice, I hope and I trust you are answering Dixon White's call. Wrapping today, as I promised you, a teaser, a taste, a token of what you'll hear on Upfront and Outspoken with Bob Williams on April 30, 40 years to the day. In fact, it'll be a Wednesday, and it was a Wednesday, the day that Saigon fell. Maybe from the Vietnamese point of view, it was the day Saigon rose, but from the American Army's point of view, it certainly was the fall of Saigon. This is from our friend, and we've heard from him before several times, our Clayton, Georgia friend, Dr. Rodney Rowe. He writes this, I was a U.S. Army flight surgeon in Vietnam from October 70 to October 71 in a small medical detachment assigned to the 335th and 135th Assault Helicopter Companies. My duties consisted of taking care of all the flying personnel and support personnel in these companies. In addition, I saw combat engineers and MACV personnel who came in looking for medical care. In addition to me, we had about six medics at any one time. We saw all of the usual infectious diseases, and I was responsible for making decisions about whether pilots could fly. From the moment I arrived in country, there was a curious admixture of the everyday and mundane with the exotic and absurd that constantly amazed me. A couple of examples. I arrived at Tonsonut Air Base on a Stretch 8 commercial airliner following a 36-hour trip from Oakland, California to Honolulu to Guam to Osaka to Vietnam. We were loaded onto buses to be transported to Long Binh Army Post. I asked why there was a hardware cloth screwed into place over the windows on our bus, and was told that was to prevent children from throwing grenades through the windows of our bus. This reinforced the fact that while the bustling scene outside looked normal, nothing was normal. We spent a couple of days sleeping and waking in barracks, getting adjusted to being transported halfway around the globe, and I'd bought a 35mm camera. I was warned to get a metal cable for the case instead of a leather strap. We were allowed to go outside the gate to shop. When I left, there was a leper at the gate begging. He had no fingers or nose. They'd fallen off. We had not walked 50 yards outside the gate when a motorcycle with a couple of teenage Vietnamese boys swerved by, grabbed my camera strap, and because I had been warned about thieves grabbing cameras, I had a tight hold on the metal cable. The boy on the back was jerked off his motorcycle. No one was hurt, and the thieves thought it was a grand joke. When I arrived at company headquarters, I asked the commanding officer what my responsibilities were. He told me, "Your responsibility is to keep your head down, survive 365 days, and go home to your wife and daughter. This whole war is bullshit. It's a political boondoggle that no one has the guts to get us out of." Welcome to Vietnam. After I was situated in Dong Tam, I saw anyone who came in, the local police chief's mother, anyone. I volunteered at the local orphanage and assisted the Philippine surgeon who worked at the local hospital during surgery. I'm sure we operated on wounded Viet Cong as well as ARVN soldiers. I also had to fly on combat missions. I was fortunately never injured. Some of the other members of the helicopter crew weren't so lucky. We had a small concrete block building that sometimes had water standing on the floor that we called the officers' club. A Vietnamese woman we called Lucy, but whose real name was Phong, was the bartender. Lucy was bright, well-educated, spoke English, French, Vietnamese, read widely, usually said little. One evening she told me, "Bác sĩ," that's doctor, "the Viet Cong know who you are. If you get killed, it will be an accident." My first reaction was relief. My second reaction was, how the hell does she know what the Viet Cong know? It was at that point that I realized that the Vietnamese on our army bases lived in two worlds. During that year, I saw things I never wanted to see again. We flew supplies to patrols, talked, promised to bring more supplies back next day, went back to find them all dead. I was attacked by a rabid dog, wasn't bitten, but my medic was, and had to get the anti-rabies vaccine. Subject to mortar fire, I could wake from sound sleep when I heard the characteristic slap of a mortar shell being fired and have my helmet and flak vest on and be in the bunker when the mortar landed. No joke. Surreal. When I returned to the States, I was in Memphis, Tennessee, 24 hours after leaving Vietnam. My wife picked me up and started driving across the Delta country of eastern Arkansas to her parents' home. Looked much like Vietnam, with the rice fields and levees. We came to a bridge with no guards, patrolling it, and I was on the floor of our car before I could think. Every bridge in Vietnam had guards to keep the Viet Cong from blowing the bridge up. An unguarded bridge. An unguarded bridge meant an ambush. I want to thank Dr. Rodney Rowe of Clayton, Georgia, so very much for this compelling, moving piece. And you will listen, please, on the 30th in the morning, 7 a.m. Eastern, to Bob Williams, upfront and outspoken, with more stories like this for the full show, as long as it takes. Upfront and outspoken, our celebration, our memorial, our remembrance of the fall of Saigon at 40. And as you listen, I want you to follow this show on Twitter at jwolf41387, because I want you to try, to keep trying to live as if justice matters, as if what you and your kids do matter. Be creative, courageous. Take your place on that great Mandela right next to me and all the writers on today's show, because this is our brief moment of time. The folk singer, the genius Phil Oakes, said, "I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here." He was so very right. Repair this crazy place, you can. I promise, when you act on justice's behalf, it does pay back, and it will most definitely make you happy. For our 77th Passionate Justice program at 3 o'clock U.S. Eastern Time on the Starcom radio and satellite network. And right now, right now, right now, follow the show on Twitter at jwolf41387. Because there and everywhere, it's Passionate Justice.
We gotta get out of this place. You know it too.